Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It is October 19th, 2020, and that was the new intro for transmission.
Yes. So thank you to Max and Sarah for doing that for us, and we hope you liked it. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
I enjoy it. It makes me feel calm and focused at the same time.
That's right.
Just to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Van Stunek. I'm the director for the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
Today we're continuing our conversation from last Friday. Oh, and Kathleen's, I love the intro. Thank you.
All right. And Kathleen, I hope you're feeling okay. Kathleen broke her toe over the weekend.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So fascism, fascism Friday is bleeding over into fascism Monday.
Monday.
No alliteration.
All fascism all the time.
Yeah, we want to be like transparent and honest about how these different things we talk about here impact us, like how we're complicit, how liberals, like how there's a systemic issue, like. And one of the things that happens anytime you criticize fascism in America, people put all that in the Trump pile and think somehow everything else is like not fascist. And so there's a lot of deception, self-deception with that. So we want to talk a little bit about how fascism is more of a facet of our society than what just pointing at Trump.
Right. Yeah, because it's sort of too easy to do that. It's like, you know, he's this big, huge, giant target that's just easy to shoot at. But that would, that would be dishonest. Oh, Kathleen's got an idea. Manic Monday. I don't know.
We could use the Bengals song as an intro.
Yeah, then get sued. Yeah. Get a cease and desist order. So to me, the image that sort of comes up in my mind every time I think about this topic is which I often see when we go bike riding. I think about it in terms of bike riding in Minneapolis, and you know, we'll take these long bike rides and head out to the suburbs somewhere, and so you're in this, you know, fancy all white suburb, and you see you see a Black Lives Matter sign. Right. So that to me is kind of the jumping off point for this conversation, because, you know, those people think of themselves as being good liberals and supporting this good liberal cause. And if you suggested that they were in the fascist camp, they'd get very angry at you. As only good liberals can do when you suggest that what they're doing is problematic. And but then if you came to those same people and said, okay, great, Black Lives Matter, we are going to raise your property taxes by 15%, and we're going to funnel that money into poor black school districts to hire and train black teachers, and we're actually going to use some of that money to increase or to decrease the economic disparity. They would not be in favor of that, generally speaking. They are not in favor of that. And, you know, that's not just hypothesis on my part. I mean, I grew up in California when the great blue liberal state passed Proposition 13, which basically gutted public schools, mostly in poor districts. So there's some kind of underlying issue and dynamic here. And I actually thought the way you were phrasing it before we got started is good. So we could continue with that.
How was I? I can't remember 5 minutes ago. I'm over 40.
You were talking about that there's two underestimations.
Oh yeah, there's like this double whammy. And you know, at some point I need to be more confessional because it's we dumped on conservatives, we're gonna dump on liberals, and I don't want people to think somehow I'm better than all that, even though mostly I am. But just to kind of double down on what liberalism does, there's like a double whammy of self-deception that goes in both directions. The underestimating of fascism in general, saying like, look, America isn't fascist. It only happens when this sort of thing happens. Like when Trump, when you see Proud Boys, when you see people having Nazi flags. Otherwise, we're a liberal democracy. That's like one self-deception, downplaying fascism. The other one is to overplay fascism, somehow saying, look, if Trump wins, or even if he doesn't, there's going to be a civil war. And basically all hell is going to break loose. And Trump alone is ushering in this fascist thing. And the only fascists in our society are these hyper-reactionaries. Otherwise, and so it's like overplaying what Trump is capable of, that somehow if we don't stop Trump now, we're going to go into Nazism. And if we do, then we're not. Like, so there's this sort of like over and underestimating at the same time.
Yeah. All right, we've got a few comments here.
Avi just said his name is Daniel Whopper. It's good.
This obvious Ellen's kid.
No need to throw up every comment for me, friends. I added that one just to be funny. Okay, Gregory.
So we might throw up at every comment somewhere, but okay.
It's fun. Gregory writes, it's Ed Freeman's systems theory notion of failure of nerve writ large. It's a combination of laziness, fear, selfishness, and lack of empathy. I want to know more about this failure of nerve
idea, yeah.
Friedman.
Yeah.
If you can say more, that'd be helpful for me. Kathleen writes, good liberals constantly tell me they would never live in my neighborhood. I intentionally moved into a diverse neighborhood where we are constantly harassed by the police.
Right. Yeah, and Kathleen, I mean, I experienced that when Deborah and I moved to Minneapolis. And, you know, we live in this very diverse neighborhood. And, you know, lots of my liberal white friends out in the suburbs would be like, oh, I would never live there. Some people were like, I would not come visit you there. Deborah went and volunteered at this clinic nearby. I think I've told the story, and the entire introduction for these white healthcare students was about how dangerous the neighborhood was. And so there is this denial, and that's really what it is, of this internalized racist, fascist approach to things. And, you know, I saw this, I saw this all the time growing up. You know, my relatives, who all consider themselves incredibly liberal people, we're constantly making racist jokes, comments of all kinds, all throughout my childhood. And I mean, for me, it was incredibly confusing because it was just like, well, wait a minute, you know, you're supposedly supporting all these cool liberal causes. You claim you're for all this equality and stuff, and, you know, listen to what's coming out of your mouths. And it was just very disorienting. Right, because there clearly is this blindness and blind spot that, you know, and it's, I mean, to me, the other thing that I think about is the whole NIMBY phenomenon, right? The not in my backyard.
Yeah.
You know, this idea, right, that, you know, well, Black Lives Matter are fine when the Black Lives are far away from me.
Or they're not disrupting my commute.
Right, my commute, yes, they're not blocking the freeway. So it's, I mean, I think that this is just incredibly important because, it, you know, the denial that we're talking about, I think in many ways is not only the thing that creates Trump and the possibility of Trump, But I also think that it's, you know, it's one of the biggest obstacles really to change and progress.
Yes, I think so. It can, just to kind of give a little bit of a framework, because, you know, when you say words like fascism, liberalism, those are contested terms. But to me, the way I'm looking at this, liberalism is part of that Enlightenment tradition that, in my, the way I think about it, privilege is individual property rights. It's still in that same framework of basically being capitalist in our society. A liberal is a capitalist who believes in having some more social welfare to keep people from falling through the gaps. That's generally more progressive socially, more willing to have government involved to do those things. But still, at the bottom line, there's this individual ownership kind of mentality that you have baked in because that's a capitalist way of thinking. And so what happens is you have all the right sentiments, but as soon as your sense of your ownership is threatened, then you still act like a fascist. To me, fascism isn't people being wearing white robes and saying, you know, racial epithets while they physically attack everyone. That is what's true, but that's not the dominant expression of it. That's the most harsh expression. No. It's a systemic thing. So again, if whether you're kill someone yourself or you're just willing to kill the cops, call the cops because someone's looking through your trash, you're still threatening someone. So like that's where liberalism just slides into fascism because fascism is just capitalism under threat.
Right. Yeah. All right. We got comments rolling in.
Leah writes, Dan, FYI, Reagan won California 52-35 and 80, and Ford won over Carter. So in 1978, California was not a blue state as it is now.
Right. Yes, this is true.
Ceres writes, the biggest self-deceptions in a lot of liberals is the dismissing the role of longing desire. Interesting. And frameworks that informs people's vulnerabilities to fascism. Yes. They also don't distinguish between power, sovereignty, and control, oppression, which creates a lot of both learned helplessness and codependency to external authority. Ceres, you always write really amazing things, and that is like one of the chewiest two sentences you've written back to back. We could spend episodes talking about all these things, but just to highlight a couple, and thank you for that comment. The other day I posted something about an article about Hannah Arendt saying that totalitarianism is built upon an experience of loneliness. She's talking about more existentially, like fascists have friends, but a sense of feeling alienated and disconnection. And I think that kind of speaks to like, there's a deep unwillingness to look at one's vulnerabilities that's tied up in the rise of fascism. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of longing and desire that you're talking about, and you also often talk about getting in touch with your body. That's the sort of stuff that I think a lot of us who are instinctively disassociate really need to do so that we're not susceptible to being manipulated by authoritarianism.
Yeah. So that individual dissociation then also gets to historical dissociation, right? And so, Gregory is often posting all these great little historical tidbits about, you know, times when black folks were killed for trying to go to the polls, from, you know, various massacres like what happened in Tulsa, which, you know, now more white people know about. But there were many of those sorts of incidents in cities all over America in the early 20th century. And you know, white people don't know anything about that. I mean, they don't know anything about any of those things. And so that's this historical dissociation, which allows us to do what you were talking about, Mark, that idea of like, well, America isn't fascist. America's fine. Like, America's this great, you know, democracy, right? And, yes. You know, and to me, we see this, this fascism denial, you know, and what you're talking about in this whole idea of constitutional originalism, you know, which we've heard a lot about with the Supreme Court hearing thing, and which again, the left folks, the liberal folks, want to say, oh, we're not into that. But it gets back to what you were talking about the roots of it, which is that, you know, capitalism is the best. and that's what we have to keep no matter what. And so there is that originalism, that kind of, we can call it enlightenment originalism, mm-hmm. which is, you know, we've stumbled upon this best system, and there's nothing wrong with it. And we just have to sort of tweak it a little bit and everybody will be fine. Which is just not true. It's just not true.
And it just, and this is again, the same instinct that happens between, I think, most liberals and most conservatives and a lot of radicals too, to think that the problem is individual shittiness. So they have mm-hmm. an okay system that could be made to work for everyone. If you didn't have this group of shitty people with their bad morals, toxifying the system.
Yeah.
And so we don't question the system. It's that move towards like individual character assassination as an attempt to purify the system. You see across the political spectrum, and it's flawed. It's a flawed way of dealing with systems change. Alan writes, I used to live in a neighborhood where the pizza place where I worked would not deliver because it was so dangerous. Like, what is dangerous here, Cindy? Another person in our same neighborhood didn't like our community garden's compost because the compost would attract bums.
What? Is that because bums eat compost?
You know, pick out all those orange peels, make some, add it to their oolong in the morning. Sirius writes, and Dan, I know the liberal NIMBY nonsense in California too well.
Yeah.
Gus writes, Schrodinger's Black Lives Matter. Schrodinger's Black Lives Matter and cannot possibly ask anything from me.
Right. They both matter, but and don't anything from it. Yes, that is great.
Adam writes, Black Lives Matter, but I'll still call the police.
Yeah.
Gregory writes, failure of nerve is when we know what is right, but the inertia of the status quo keeps us bound to what is rather than summoning the energy and resolve to create what should be. It's nice. It's helpful to know. It's kind of like having to have a rocket booster to break the gravitational pull of the Earth to launch the space shuttle.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, this to me gets back to the spiritual practice challenge that that we were getting around to on Friday, and that when people talk about spiritual practice being hard, what they're really talking about is that kind of failure of nerve piece, that as your mind and your ego habits start to dissolve, you panic, you know, your ego freaks out and you experience this existential angst and you just want to stop. And that's this kind of spiritual failure of nerve. And all of these, you know, all of these habits and defense mechanisms and denial mechanisms and everything like comes to the fore to try to rescue your ego self. And you know, the nerve that is required is the courage to kind of keep going, you know, and if we look at the Jesus gospel stories, right, there were all these moments when the crowd all went away. Right? And suddenly Jesus turns around. He's like, wow, where'd everybody go? It's like, well, you know, everybody got scared. Like your teachings were too radical. And so everybody left. And that's, you know, in a story form, that same kind of spiritual process.
Adam writes, I look around at all of the Black Lives Matter signs, and while it's encouraging, I also wonder to what extent they were put up out of fear of the property damage that was happening during the protests.
Yeah. We definitely saw a lot of that in our neighborhood. and you know, they weren't even subtle about it. They'd be things like, you know, don't burn us down.
We like black people.
You know, we like black people. Black people are here. Yeah, which in some cases was true, but in some cases was actually not.
And even before, like one of the quips I would hear is that you can tell a neighborhood is being gentrified by its presence of coffee shops and Black Lives Matter signs. And so there is sort of a liberal like virtue signaling that happened even before. That wasn't about that. Still had like a gross tinge.
Yeah.
And to be fully confessional, we have one out front, and functionally speaking, I'm not sure how easy it would be for someone to tell the difference between me and an urban liberal. So I'm not being self-congratulatory. Yeah.
Well, and you know, and this to me is sort of a perfect example, another perfect example on a very practical level, right? This whole issue of gentrification. I mean, people talk about gentrification as if it's, again, some individual moral failure. Like, oh, you know, this mean person comes in and wants to, you know, fix up their house or, you know, screw over the neighborhood. But the reality is that gentrification is inevitable when you put property in a capitalist system. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, prices are going to go up. And now you've also got the most regressive kind of taxation tied to property values, which are property taxes. So your property tax is connected to the value of your property. And so those two things right there are going to guarantee that people who are poor are going to be driven out of the neighborhood. And, you know, and then furthermore, on top of that, you get the very incredibly racist phenomenon, right? Of that, if let's say you're in an all black or person of color neighborhood, the valuations of those properties tend to be 20 to 30% lower for the exact same property than in a white neighborhood, which then assures that the property taxes in that neighborhood are going to be less, which means that things like schools, funding for all kinds of public services are going to go down. So this entire system is there. It doesn't matter how nice or not nice or liberal or fascist or conservative or whatever you are as an individual. That entire system assures the maintenance of all these sorts of social ills that we're talking about. And so until you address and change that, you know, it doesn't really matter what the individual wants to do or does within the context of that system.
No, and so like there's often an emphasis on individual kind of actions like shopping and recycling, which aren't bad. Like any movement has to have these sorts of buy-ins personally for you to feel invested, and it's part of the formation process. So like that's important. But the important thing isn't like having some sentiments and having a sign out front and even a George Floyd picture. It's about like, how do I work within my different political circles, neighborhood, city, to advocate for some sort of more collectivized understanding of ownership so that there's a mitigation against these social forces so that you find ways that people who aren't white and middle class can move in too much. And so that's hard work. So it's easier just to have sentiments about it and assume that people who share your sentiments are good and people who are really against your sentiments are bad, and that the problem is sentimental, which is what we fall into in our society all the time. And that's part of the self-deception of liberalism, is that it's sentimentalism matters, more than black lives even. The general public has been very comfortable with various modes of control because they have had a nice face. Honestly, even when they haven't, many have considered it normal and been okay with state violence and manipulative messaging.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
Leah writes, there's a lot of NIMBYism in my very Hispanic neighborhood. That is not very liberal at all. Aspirational NIMBYism, perhaps. So, internalized oppression is a thing. So, like, we could talk about Ice Cube and stuff. There's been a whole fiasco with him recently, and I think that touches on something. Gregory writes, the neoliberal answer to slavery in 1800 would have been that we need more black slaveholders. That would be seen as the radical edge, because the mainstream edge, the mainstream liberal edge would be, we need more slave owners like Benedict Cumberbatch and 12 of the Slave. The nice, well-meaning, I feel bad about enslaving you, but what you gonna do? Adam writes, people without homes are rats now. Actually, compost doesn't even attract rats.
Yeah, that's relative to the compost.
Well, in my, like, we don't mix ours in well enough, so we get squirrels in it, but I like squirrels. Adam writes, right, Gregory, thanks for that. I've thought a lot about the gravity of what we believe is true, possible, and impossible. Yeah. Ellen writes, that person was a landlord who open carried, so she had some absurd assumptions. Something about landlord and open carry together in a sentence ratchets things up a little bit, you know? A good example of failure of nerve is Exodus 14 account of the Egyptians pursuing the Israelites and they start to panic. The key is to, as Dan said, keep going.
Right.
David appreciated the phrase, fascism is capitalism under threat. I think Orwell wrote, fascism is capitalism plus murder, which I generally agree with, but I think capitalism is already murder. So this is murder squared, I guess. Catherine writes, I had conversations during the white supremacist mass violence in Charlottesville with liberal fascism deniers who claimed that there were only a few white supremacists out there, but were also somehow convinced that Antifa was a major threat. This whole Antifa thing is another angle of this.
Yeah.
Which we've talked about plenty. You know, I could go off on that. It felt very like they had no interest in observing reality.
Yeah. I guess the light of the torches was sort of blinding them as to how many people were really there. So it just seemed like just a few.
Yeah. There's a Bible story about that, torches or something, isn't there? I don't remember. Connor writes, how do we change those systems that seem so impossible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it really does seem that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does. And, you know, and it's a long, long process. And that's, to me, part of the liberal fascist in denial, is this whole, like, oh, I'm so exhausted by all of this protesting stuff. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many liberals I hear with it. Like, oh my gosh, you know, I went to 3 protests. I'm really tired of thinking about this. Right. And it's this thing of, okay, well, I did my thing. I've got my sign up. I just want everything to go back to normal. Right. And the whole notion of, I have to spend my whole life working on this. Like, this is my whole life. You know, and as somebody, you know, who's now been doing this for almost 5 decades, I can tell you, like, yeah, there hasn't been a whole lot of progress. But my attitude and approach is, this is my whole life. Like, working on these things is the main thing. And I may never see any change, right? I may never see any significant change. But that doesn't mean I stop working on it and I just say, oh, I'm tired. I just want to forget about it. And so I think that's really the key. And this is very much at the core of spiritual teachings. You will never see enlightenment in your life. You may never see the kingdom of God manifest in your life. That doesn't mean you stop practicing. It just is recognizing that our lifetime is a tiny little blip in the big scheme of things. And that's okay. And that's part of humility, really.
This, to me, ties in with the whole conversation we had like 40 episodes ago about polarization. So I hear a lot of, and this to me exposes a liberal mentality generally. And when I see someone talking about polarization a lot, I assume they're a liberal because the issue is they assume that there wasn't already a polarity. There's already people for and against, like, please pick black people. And that was submerged from the public discourse. When it ruptures into the public discourse and all of a sudden what was before optional, like extracurricular, caring about justice. If you're white, justice concerns, white middle-class people, justice is an extracurricular activity. You don't have to think about it. When you're forced to think about it, suddenly you're aware of polarities that were there the whole time. And so then you start complaining about polarization, buildings burning, and you'd rather have that go away and you think that makes things better without ever addressing the underlying cause. And so this is the whole white liberal mentality that, you know, King and a bunch of people have talked about. Yeah. Is the polarity was already there. You're just only noticing now when it inconveniences you, and now you're suddenly tired, so you're going to go back to treating it as extracurricular.
Right.
Colin writes, any thoughts on the relationship between the erasure of working class history and struggle in the U.S. and our collective proclivity to not deny what's really happening right now? Oh, my God. That's like a dissertation question.
All right. Well, it's a great question. And what I would say is that it's directly related, right? That, you know, and that's one of the things that American culture tries to do, right, is to pretend that there are no classes There's no class distinction in America. We're all the same, right? You know, the billionaire and the person that scrubs toilets, they're the same. There's no difference. There's no class distinction. You know, Bernie Sanders has a couple million dollars in the bank. That's no different from, you know, what's his name? I'm blanking on the New York guy who's the super billionaire that ran for office for a few minutes.
I'm blanking, you know, there's, too, thankfully.
Yeah. You know, there's no difference between those guys. And yeah. And yeah, and that's, that denial is exactly a part of this. Very, very similar.
It's a big reason why I think people in the United States are uniquely conditioned among other similar nations to not have systems analysis. It's because we don't have a way of thinking about society at a structural level. We don't talk about it that way. We talk about things almost exclusively in terms of how individuals successfully or unsuccessfully engage within a system. You hear, anytime you hear conversations about millennials versus boomers and wealth shift, this stuff comes forward like crazy. Scott writes, strategic question for denial. What doesn't complement denial? I'm not sure we're getting, like, how do we counteract denial? Is that?
Yeah. Is that, maybe you could say more.
Yeah.
No.
Catherine writes, meanwhile, anti-fascist individuals were saving some of my clergy friends' lives from actual crowds of Nazis with bats and guns. They're, I mean, I don't see any difference. Yeah, I've,
yes.
Yes. Yeah. Good point.
Don't get us going on Antifa, especially when we're 2 minutes over time.
Yeah. Jen writes, regarding Sharon D. Walsh's A Feminist Ethic of Risk, which is incredible, where she discusses failure of nerve as overwhelm for the middle class in particular of comprehending the big picture. As Daniel said, this complexity has resulted in a failure of nerve.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. Another good writes, book to read.
Buffalo Bill's dad was part of founding Kansas. Missouri people hated them, saying Kansasians, or Kansians, what do you call someone from Kansas? were abolitionists. Reason they didn't want any black people in Kansas. At all. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, Oregon was the same thing.
Wow. Adam writes, it's wild how much we've embraced the corporatization of everything, government, education, et cetera, which only tightens fascism's grip. Talking about potential presidents as having experience in the private sector. No one challenged that when media sources normalized that around 10 years ago or whatever. At least to me, that seemed like something new at the time. It was appalling.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is where if you don't look at and question capitalism and you assume that that's fine, you're going to really get into a lot of trouble because, you know, we've seen this. The corporation just looks for the next place to gobble up. And in our society, the next place for it to gobble up was the public sector. And so we've seen that, you know, so let's privatize everything. Let's privatize prisons, schools, social services, parks, but you know, land, everything, because that's this huge chunk of stuff that, you know, the corporations see is up for grabs and let's now grab it and make a profit out of it. And of course, what that means is that all of those things are going to get worse. Yeah.
Bloomberg is the New York guy.
Ah, yes, Bloomberg, right.
Patricia writes, denial or ignorance? And Adam adds, it's a thin line between willful ignorance and denial.
Yeah, well, what I would say is that the denial is the psychological process that promotes ignorance. So that, you know, yeah, if you just don't see something, then you are ignorant of it.
Yeah, and I think the word ignorance is complex and often... when people say it, they assume the solution is education. And what they usually mean by education is the presentation of information in one direction.
Right.
And so when people assume.
Denial is expert at.
Yeah. So
ninja-ing.
It's not a lack of present information or possibilities, although that is a part of it. Like if you don't know about the alternatives, you don't know about the alternatives. That's true. Mm-hmm. But denial is more. I think it's more foundational, as Dan said. It shapes our consciousness, helping us, keeping us from accessing certain information in any sort of experiential way.
And I think we need to end with Ellen's comment there.
Dan, are you Sisyphus smiling? I don't understand what that means.
Yeah, it's the spiritual practice idea. You're just pushing the rock up the hill. Rock down the hill. You push it up the hill again.
I get it now. Sorry.
And it rolls back down the hill.
Yeah. Sisyphean. Yeah. Sisyphean smiling. Scott adds, I like courage better than the line about nerve. And that's also an answer to the question proposed. Courage doesn't complement denial. Have courage and face denial. Denial is a fear. Fear of facing how much fascism hurts, for example. Yeah, I think courage in a certain way. And again, even that phrase has been hijacked into hypermasculinity. But there's a courage that's not masculinist that I think is essential to me. And it's that kind of courage is almost indistinguishable from humility to me. Right.
Yeah. So spiritual teachings talk a lot about fearlessness. Yeah.
And concluding thought from Adam, let us not forget the toxic river of culture, which also shapes our thinking.
Amen. There we go. All right. So for now, thank you very much. Another great series of comments, and you may get in your little boats and float down the toxic river of our culture until tomorrow.
I'm realizing I'm not going to be able to do tomorrow. So Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Sorry.
So Wednesday. And we will be like a little island in the toxic river where you can park your boat for a few moments of rest.
Respite. See y'all later.
See ya. Thank you.